This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Tis the season to take the kids to see The Nutcracker. The fairy tale ballet with music composed by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky has become a holiday tradition in this country. It had its debut in St. Petersburg right before Christmas, I should say, in 1892, and was first staged in the United States by the San Francisco Ballet in 1944. The Pennsylvania Ballet is performing George Balanchine's The Nutcracker at the Academy of Music through December 31st. Today in Radio Times, we're going to explore and celebrate Tchaikovsky's beautiful and evocative score that has both endured and been reworked many times. Here's Duke Ellington's 1960 rendition of the overture. Let's give it a listen. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Beatrice Jonah Afram, music director and conductor of the Pennsylvania Ballet. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So nice to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is David Fox. He's a lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in theater arts and English, also a theater critic for Philadelphia Magazine, and has been a semi-regular on Radio Times talking about music. David, nice to have you back with us.
It's wonderful to be back. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Beatrice, how many times have you conducted The Nutcracker?
I think I'm creeping up on 400.
Oh, my goodness.
And do you remember your first time?
Very, very vividly. It was here in Philadelphia, of course, and I was eased into it, which was so kind of them to let me do. I did Act 1 one day and Act 2 the second day, and then the third day I did the whole show. And it was a very kind way to indoctrinate me.
Is it because it's hard to do?
It is hard to do. And as an assistant conductor, which I was at the time, this was in 1993, assistant conductors don't get to rehearse with the orchestra and dancers. They are thrown in. And so it was a particularly nice way to sort of find my feet.
And is it different every time for you? As you said, you've done this perhaps 400 times. Different every time?
It is different every time. It's wonderfully different every time. There are just enough moving parts. Musicians who are in and out and change during the course of a run, and dancers, we had, think, have eight casts of the principal couple, the Sugar Plum Fairy and her Cavalier. So it's remarkably different, and that's certainly what helps to keep it alive for all of us.
I mean, David, the music is beautiful. I'll just put that out there.
Indeed.
I don't think that's going too far out on a limb.
Beautiful and enduring. As you said, I think you said this, that the ballet was actually initially not especially well received, but Tchaikovsky obviously had some kind of grand master plan from the beginning, because the suite, the condensed suite, which is actually quite short, 20 minutes and eight pieces, he had worked really around the same time. It was kind of ready to go after the ballet premiered. And the general consensus, I think, is that it's the suite and the popularity of it that gave rebirth to The Nutcracker and brought it back into popularity.
And as you listen to Tchaikovsky, and he died, I think, a year or so after its debut, how do you, I guess, put this into some of it? You can hear, I guess, strands of his other music clearly.
Yes, I think you can. I'll just say a couple of things about it, and then Beatrice, I hope you'll take off from there. The one thing I think is the interest in national styles, and this is a common practice, I think, in his ballets. a Russian dance, an Arabian dance that evoke particular kinds of culture. And we were talking earlier about the magic of the orchestration, the kind of shimmering quality that goes on in a lot of this. And I think that's both in some way specific to Nutcracker, but also overriding.
Yeah, I think the Nutcracker sort of combines some strands from his past, but also amazing innovation, sort of revolutionary use of the orchestra. In fact, there's an instrument that he uses in this piece, the celeste, which is sometimes called the celeste, and it appears in Act Two, which he had actually used before in a piece that nobody liked or listened to. So this is the one that people, you know, that really they associate it with most clearly. And a celeste is basically a glockenspiel with a piano keyboard, and is played by a pianist. And this is the sound that we hear as we are introduced to the character of the Sugar Plum Fairy. It's the sound that tells us that we are in a new place, a magical place. Another sound that folks had not heard before was something called flutter tonguing. So the flutes start playing this strange sound, which is the introduction of all of these characters from these national dances that David was referring to. So yes, there's a lot of, if you think about, say, the music for the pas de deux, which is built on this descending scale, which is a very typical gesture for Tchaikovsky. I think that what makes the piece, one of the most important elements that makes the piece so enduring is his use of the orchestra and the colors. He really used it like a palette of paints.
Well, I'd love to, you sent over, and I appreciate that, some pieces from the Pennsylvania Ballet, and this is playing the Russian dance conducted by our guest, Beatrice Afram. Let's give it a listen. That's you conducting.
Yes, it's the orchestra playing. You can hear the applause, the audience reacting to the dancer on stage. So.
And what was the response, going back, I guess, David, when it debuted, response to both, I guess, the ballet and also the music? And I have in my hand here some of the, I would say, pretty harsh criticisms of the ballet.
Well, I think even today, it's a bit of a surprise, I think, the ballet. It's a lot more, it's heavier on mime than it is really on classical ballet, certainly until you get well into the second act. It's a fantasy, certainly, but it's a more domestic story. And I think some of the things now that seem so appealing about it must have seemed very kind of oddly off to critics and audiences that were used to Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, which was very virtuosic and very much a kind of fairy tale worlds.
You say that Tchaikovsky kind of cleaned up a story. It was a little less creepy once he sort of played with the E.T.A. Hoffman story.
Yes, I'm no expert on the E.T.A. Hoffman, but my sense is that that's what happened. Although I think even now it is as many fairy tales are, has a kind of an odd charge to it.
You say it that way?
Oh, absolutely. The first time I saw it, I'll just show myself as the rube that I was when I first started working here, which is I had never seen it before when I was the assistant conductor, and I came to see a performance, and Act Two ended, and I sat in my seat waiting for Act Three. Because I thought, well, surely she has to wake up from her dream and we're going to finish the story. But that doesn't happen. So it is absolutely and very strangely open-ended.
some of the reviews of when it debuted. This is, in some, it's a pity that such good music is expected to, on such nonsense, so unworthy of attention, but the music in general is excellent. Another review, such a great composer should not have taken upon himself such a trifle and such nonsense as the story of this ballet. I mean, pretty harsh criticism, maybe less of the music and more of the ballet and perhaps even the story.
I think so, and I think that there's also some sort of criticism of the idea that children would play such a prominent part in the story, because of course when the children do dance, and Mr. Balanchine was extremely dedicated to giving them juicy stuff to do, but there being children on stage, one is not going to see the kind of technical fireworks that one does in Swan Lake or Sleeping
Beauty. I mean, the role that children play, obviously, in
well,
the story.
Well, I think, and absolutely, but I also think it was kind of a wonderful way for Balanchine. You know, it's a play, it's a ballet about family. Fundamentally, it's a you know, Christmas Eve with family and a gathering. And the structure of it, I think, has always allowed ballet companies, and particularly this was true with the City Ballet, with Balanchine, to bring back some of their older dancers to do the adult parts, in the mime parts. But also, many ballet companies have schools that are affiliated with it. They can use their students. And so, in a way, it's a celebration of the family of the company in this ballet for families about families.
And when did you first see it, David?
Well, I may not have seen it actually until I was well into my adult years.
Well, sort of because, like our other guest
well,
here. Yeah.
I grew up in Los Angeles in an era before we had a resident ballet company. So I probably watched bits of it on television. And I strangely remember from childhood being told that children in New York got to put on fancy clothes and go see the Nutcracker at the City Ballet at Lincoln Center and then go to Rumpelmeyer's for ice cream. And I thought, kind of, where do I sign up? Like, this is the childhood I want. And I finally managed to do exactly that, but probably when I was 35.
Including the restaurant?
Yeah. I went to Rumpelmeyer's before it closed. I did. Yeah.
And this, the Pennsylvania Ballet is doing George Balanchine's The Nutcracker, and that's significant. Why?
It's significant, well, partly because we've been doing it since the 1980s. It's a long time, and it's a very beloved tradition. And I don't think Philadelphia really wants us to do another version.
Tradition, right?
That's what Christmas and this time of year seems to be so much about. People are counting on it, and you know, I sometimes, you know, and when I'm starting to fray a little around the edges, I think, gosh, you know, what again? Really? And families again, really? But then what I do is something that's a little hallmark-y, but actually helps me very much get through the experience, which is as I exit the theater, I try to walk into the sea of people coming out, and then I'm reminded, right, that for some people it's their very first time. A lot of those people. And for other people, even if it's not, they're enjoying it every bit as much, if not more, because they're there with someone else or a baby has arrived or bringing their grandchild for the first time. And it's a very important experience for them.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. More music as well. We are talking about the music of The Nutcracker, Tchaikovsky's final ballet. Beatrice Jonah Afron is a music director, conductor of the Pennsylvania Ballet. I should add that they are performing George Balanchine's Nutcracker at the Academy of Music through December 31st. Also with us is David Fox, lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and English, also theater critic for Philadelphia Magazine. And we're going to take a very short break. We got lots of music queued up and opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, talking with Beatrice Jonah Afron and David Fox about the music from The Nutcracker, of course, composed by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky, in many ways the official Christmas soundtrack for America. And I do want to play another clip, if I can put it that way, from the Pennsylvania Ballet. And this is the very famous Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, conducted by our guest, Beatrice Afron.
Thank you.
Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy is performed by the Pennsylvania Ballet, conducted by our guest, Beatrice Affron. And there was that instrument that you mentioned earlier.
That's right, the celesta, which is, after all, the name indicates that it's celestial and otherworldly. And one of the things I get a big kick out of is how it's combined right away with the bass clarinet, that very low sound at the beginning, which is a device that Tchaikovsky, in fact, uses a lot during the ballet, high and low. And it creates this beautiful and very odd combinations.
Yeah,
no, I think you only need a couple of notes of it if you've heard it before to recall it, because it is a very strange, kind of haunting set of textures, I think, even before you get to the melody, which is obviously very, very famous.
And my understanding is that Tchaikovsky wanted to, premiered this instrument with this piece of music and kept it very quiet,
That's true. I read recently, though, that he also used it in a suite from an opera that had no success, and he wrote this suite called the Vojvoda, and that itself also didn't succeed. So this effectively is the premiere of this instrument.
Well, I think one of the signs of a great piece of music is the fact that so many people can take it and turn it into something else and make it their own.
Absolutely.
So while we have the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy is performed by the Pennsylvania Ballet in our head, let's listen to Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, performed by the a cappella group, the Pentatonix, and this is from last year. Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, performed by the a cappella group, the Pentatonix. And I was looking at both of you, but David, I was looking at you in particular, listening to that. What did you hear?
Well, it's so much fun. Initially, I missed the celesta, but on the other hand, the use of the kind of scatting bass voice to give the floor of that piece is pretty exciting. And I think it's just magical and fun and kind of evokes the world of Nutcracker, but in a new way.
And it reminds me of all those Bach, you know, people could take Bach and scat to it or their own a cappella version
of that.
That's
right. I mean, and there's also something very authentic about it. They were definitely looking at the score when they figured out their arrangement. And they were very faithful to it in their own way.
You know, it reminds me, in a way, as a kid, I think my parents had this idea that Tchaikovsky was a great way to introduce a child, a great composer to introduce a child to classical music. And I'm sure they weren't alone in this. It certainly worked for me. And part of it is the melodies and the marches and the sort of danceability of this piece and his others. But at the same time, I think as I've gotten older, and I hope a more sophisticated listener, I just hear how extraordinary the craftsmanship is, and the orchestrations are just unbelievable, the imagination behind them.
Yeah, I was remembering, actually, as I was listening to our version, the version that he wrote, how he juxtaposes, as I said before, the high and the low, and how this keeps happening. There's a moment that I just love that probably passes people by, where the tuba and the triangle, the highest of the high and the lowest of the low, come in together. And it happens sprinkled throughout the thing. And I really think that is so much the magic of this piece. Yes, the melodies are so beautiful, but it's these sounds, it's these combinations of sounds and sort of sound worlds that he creates, and how distinctly different they are in Act Two alone. If you go from one variation to another, you know, the Spanish and the Arabian and so on and so on, they're all so distinctly different. And he seemed to be really making a project of that, committed to that idea.
A little bit earlier, we were talking about sort of our favorite moments in the score, and For me, it's the Dance of the Reed Pipes, which is it's a very short piece, but this kind of shimmering texture that you get from all of this, from these wind instruments, that just this constant sense of movement. It's it's quite extraordinary, I think.
The little that I know about Tchaikovsky is that he seemed to be such a tortured soul, seemed to have such inner demons, talking about his music as, quote, all ugliness. I don't know if he was referring to this or everything that he ever wrote, but it's so interesting to contrast this tortured soul with this beautiful music.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's how you get beautiful music. I don't know. Perhaps that was for him.
I think he was not alone. I think there are many others who suffered similarly, but he suffered particularly.
Yeah.
And a lot of his music is in a minor, is both sort of specifically and figuratively in a minor key. Some very kind of somber passages in his operas and his symphonic music. But at the same time, it's capable of this extraordinary joyousness, I think, and nowhere more so than Nutcracker to me.
Well, we are talking about the Nutcracker, the music of the Nutcracker, the composer Tchaikovsky. That's David Fox, lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and English, theater critic for Philadelphia Magazine. Also with us, Beatrice Jonah Affron. She's the music director and conductor of the Pennsylvania Ballet. And I should add that the Pennsylvania Ballet performing George Balanchine's The Nutcracker at the Academy of Music through December 31st. 1-888-477-9499. I've got a bunch of emails here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me first get Gloria from Clearwater, Florida to join us. Gloria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have gone to the Nutcracker since I was a young child and even took my daughters to it as they were growing up. But I had gotten very bored with the Balanchine execution of the ballet. And I just, here in St. Petersburg, they're going to be having the Moscow Ballet doing something that is not a Balanchine version of the Nutcracker. And they talked about it having a lot more younger dancers and just being a lot different than the Balanchine version. Have either of you had any exposure to any of the other versions of that?
Gloria, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there are many, many versions of the Nutcracker. And in fact, I think there's a channel on television that devotes itself this time of year to showing the world many of these different versions. And so I absolutely encourage people to enrich their experience of the Nutcracker by seeing as many versions of it as possible, because there are some really astonishing different interpretations. And for instance, Mark Morris, whose company performs at BAM every year, adheres much more closely to the E.T.A. Hoffmann version. And so it's a much sort of darker interpretation.
Oh,
and they do this wonderful thing in the snow scene where the dancers come out and they throw the snow up in the air as they're dancing. And it's just spectacular.
Yeah, that's the first one I think of also. A hard nut is what he calls it. And it's a very odd piece, I think, because it simultaneously is in a way a kind of parody of aspects of the Nutcracker, of traditional Nutcrackers, but is all and it's also very much a kind of 1970s or 80s family household. Looks very much like that, but at the same time, it is also, I think, very much at the heart of some of the beauty of the piece. And he manages to both sort of parody it and admire it and make love to it at the same time. It's a beautiful piece, the Hard Nut, I think.
There was a piece about the Nutcracker saying that there are many versions, including one called the Slut Cracker, the Butt Cracker Suite. I mean, I guess, David, you can have a lot of fun with this if you want.
Well, and there's currently very popular in New York also that's being done, I think, at the Minetta Lane Theater, is a piece called Nutcracker Rouge, which is a kind of a drag troupe, a troupe Nutcracker. So yes, you can have your Nutcrackers in a variety of different ways.
That's right, and it's also a testament to how enduring the music, the story, the whole thing is. It can take all these different variations.
Well, you mentioned before we went on the air, Beatrice, that your favorite, if I can say this, transformation to the snow scene.
That is my favorite moment musically.
And you sent over, this is a piece performed by the Pennsylvania Ballet Orchestra, conducted by you, our guest, Beatrice Affron. Tell us why you like this so much and we'll give it a listen.
It's this moment where the story quiets down completely. And in Balanchine's version, it quiets down to the point where really the only thing happening on stage is there's a bed traveling around the stage. So he's really asking the audience to really listen to the orchestra at that point, because visually there isn't a whole lot going on. And it's a moment where it's kind of a conductor's dream moment, where we're not really being asked to conduct at one tempo or another, which is, of course, a very important and, you know, also treasured part of my job in many ways. And it allows the orchestra just to shine. And it's just this transcendent piece of music.
Let's give it a listen. Transformation to the Snow Scene, performed by the Pennsylvania Ballet, conducted by our guest Beatrice Affron. I mean, it's a very grand piece of music, it seems.
It's a very grand piece of music. And some choreographers have used that music to create a snow pas de deux for dancers. But that's not what happens here. And so there's this really wonderful sort of zooming in on the music itself at that moment.
We have an email from Barbara. She says, can you talk about the difference between the various soloist dancers' interpretations and how it's related to the role of the conductor and a live orchestra? You're the conductor, so you're conducting the music, obviously, the orchestra, and also watching what's going on stage.
That's right. This is the Nutcracker is sort of, from the conductor's point of view, like conducting two different ballets, really, because Act One, I can be very focused on the orchestra. There isn't a whole lot of dancing going on in Balanchine's version, but in Act Two, the spotlight shines very brightly on the dancers, and it's part of the fun of my job is to watch different folks run out on stage and dance their variations or dance the pas de deux, and they all do it a little differently.
Right.
And for some of them, it's their very first time. And for some of them, they've been doing it for, you know, 15 years. Not that many of those people, but a few. And it's a very engaged process. There's really a lot of communication that's going on, tacitly on their part, between dancer and conductor. And it's really, truly one of the joys of my job.
Also, this notion that George Balanchine, I guess it's his choreography, David, that we so associate with the Nutcracker, how did that come about?
Well, he was, I think, a major figure in the reappreciation of the piece. In 1954, so you said American premiere was San Francisco in 44, but he brought it to the City Ballet in 1954 with the idea of reconstructing it. And one of the things about Balanchine's Nutcracker is that it is one of the few that uses almost the entire score in its. I think, in fact, it is the entire score plus a couple of pieces from Sleeping Beauty.
So,
I know he's played around with it a little bit.
Right, he took the Sugar Plum Variation and put it at the beginning of Act Two. He removed the Cavalier's Variation entirely. There are a couple of little cuts, and he adds a big violin solo, beautifully performed
right, yeah.
by our first two violinists in the orchestra, to sort of create this transition into the more magical part of the ballet.
But I think it became the canonical Nutcracker, and many regional companies do something that at least nods to it, and I think it is a wonderful Nutcracker.
A comment from Raphael. He says, I was introduced to the Nutcracker through the film Fantasia, and of mm-hmm. course, Eugene Ormandy,
absolutely,
Philadelphia
yeah,
Orchestra.
And in fact, you know, that might have been my introduction to it, too, even before I ever saw it as a ballet, that I would have seen the pieces in the suite mm. that are so kind of wonderfully utilized in that piece.
Right. And I'm assuming, even though you've done this some 400 times, there are probably little things you do differently either each time as a conductor?
I hope so. Yeah,
that's the
because
idea.
We don't want it to freeze and die, right? It's really essential. So I'm not. It's not even just that I'm responding to the folks on stage. I'm also responding to the folks in the pit, and they to me. So there is a remark. I think it would be impossible to calculate the amount of communication that's going on, sort of all the time. It's just not happening in a vacuum whatsoever.
Could I just add one thing about the transformation music? Because I think. It's important to remember that with all of the kind of silliness and magic that's going on around this, that there is something actually quite profound, I think, at the core of Nutcracker that has to do with Marie and the Nutcracker Prince sort of understanding something about each other because they've connected in a way. And I think that's especially magical in the Balanchine version, the growing of the Christmas tree and the fact that he's... I mean, this master choreographer was so smart as to say, we're not going to dance this. We're going to actually let you kind of absorb it as a musical and scenic moment. And I think it is a really deep section of that piece, even though people aren't dancing on the stage at that moment.
Right.
Maybe
because
of that.
We have a tweet from Anvil says, it's like the tree itself. The dinner party is the bare tree. The fantasy vignettes are the magic ornaments.
The tree is big, and the sets and costumes also just beautiful. Our sets and costumes are were built within the last 10 years, actually, and they the very first scene that one during the overture that one sees is based on a Philadelphian house along the river. So it's also personal to Philadelphia what we have here.
I read somewhere that when Balanchine first staged this First City Ballet, that the board of directors were kind of freaking out about how much it was going to cost to have this this Christmas tree. And they said, can we cut it? Can we really need this Christmas tree that goes up? And the Balanchine apparently said, the Christmas tree is the Nutcracker.
Oh, interesting. So it stays.
It stayed, yes. It stayed. And I think it was a good decision because it remains with us 60 years later, 60 plus years later.
Well, we are talking about the Nutcracker, playing selections, some from the Pennsylvania Ballet, from an a cappella group. We have some others queued up as well. David Fox with us, lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and English. Beatrice Jonah Afram is the music director and conductor of the Pennsylvania Ballet. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Beatrice Jonah Afram and David Fox about the music of the Nutcracker composed by Tchaikovsky. I should add the Pennsylvania Ballet is performing George Balanchine's The Nutcracker at the Academy of Music through December 31st, featuring the Philadelphia Boys Choir. And I do want to play another version from the Nutcracker. This is the March of the Maccabees. It's a klezmer rendition from 1998 from the Shirim Klezmer Orchestra.
I love it.
It's great. I mean, again, it's what you can do to this music. And there's that minor key you were talking about, David.
Well, I think, you know, in a way, a work of art like this, now, you know, having been with us for quite a long time, belongs to the public and gets morphed and remixed, and maybe nowhere more so in ballet than Nutcracker, which has these kind of odd and interesting versions of the music that have been done by different groups, but also of the ballet itself, kind of reinvented.
Well, we have that phenomenon right here in Philadelphia. When people exit the theater, there's a guy standing on the corner playing excerpts of the Nutcracker on his saxophone.
Oh, excellent.
So the experience continues even as they leave the doors. Yeah.
Your background is actually opera first, is that right?
Well, I was an opera kid as I was growing up in New York City. I wasn't taken to see New York City Ballet, but I was taken to the Metropolitan Opera a great deal. And I grew up playing the violin and never imagining that I would be a conductor at all, and certainly not a conductor for ballet, which I knew very little about, but things turned out well, yeah.
Now, you have two performances later today. Here you are on the radio. Are there things that you do to prepare, or can you slide into the...
I sort of slide into this one. I wouldn't say so much about the other series that we do, but I like to show up at the theater half hour before, kind of, you know, be calm for a few minutes and check and see who's dancing the mm-hmm. principal roles and say hi to the musicians and go.
And can you feel the sort of, especially with kids in an audience, the kind of hubbub behind you?
Oh, I can feel and hear. Yeah, right behind me, sitting right behind kids hanging over into the pit, which actually we love.
Oh,
that's terrific. Because they're really paying attention and listening.
Let me get, looks like Sharon from East Jewett, New York, to join us. Sharon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to see if the guests could say something about the Arabian dance, which is one of my favorite parts. Because the costume of the dancer is so different than a usual ballet, and the posture of the dancer is so different. I just wanted to see if they could say something about that.
Sure, Sharon. Yeah, thanks for the call.
So,
go ahead, David.
I'm most familiar with this in the Balanchine setting, where it is a kind of it evokes a very kind of slinky sort of Middle Eastern look and feel. It is often... at least at City Ballet, it was often danced by a number of the sort of prominent dancers who were especially good at this very sinuous sort of movement. Wendy Whalen is the one that I remember so well. And I think it's with little finger symbols, as
mm-hmm,
I recall,
that's right.
Which is also just a very effective touch that it is a very kind of mystical moment, I think.
Yeah, it's a relatively quiet moment in the score, and the choreography is so beautiful there. She's doing lots of jumps and sort of horse-like, Arabian horse-like gestures, but very, very elegant and very beautiful.
Yeah.
Let me see what Chris from South Jersey has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I just wanted to make a comment. I think it was about 5 years ago. Both my daughters are harpists. And one was hired for the Wilmington Ballet, and they did a great production at the Hotel DuPont.
Sure.
But it was the worst snowstorm, and the governor never declared an emergency, so I had a two-and-a-half-hour ride to get to the performance. They did a 2 o'clock performance and canceled at 6 o'clock. But I will always have the nutcracker on my mind after that experience.
That's a great... We did have a series of very cold and snowy winters for a while.
We did, and I can only remember one time when they actually had to cancel a performance. There have been other times when I've been very fortunate not to have to commute very far, and some of the musicians have to come from very far away to get there, and they do. They get there, and it's always actually very moving. And having a small audience on sort of disastrous days like that is a very sort of a galvanizing experience. Everybody feels that they're in it, and they're very enthusiastic, and we're so appreciative.
Well,
my
New York Nutcracker was not snowy, but it was the coldest weather I have ever experienced in my life. I flew in from Los Angeles, so I was not really prepared for this. And I remember
not acclimated quite yet.
I remember seeing a thermometer on a New York building that said 5 degrees, and I thought, oh, I guess the first lights out or something. But no, it really was about 5 degrees. And people were actually wearing, it was cold enough even in the State Theater where New York City Ballet played that we kept our coats and scarves on. But it was,
but it's memorable.
Those are those moments
that just get cemented.
And in a way, it made it all the more kind of special.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play another version of Tchaikovsky's The Nutcracker. This is Waltz of the Flowers. From 2005 by electronic musician Mike Muniak. Let's give that a listen. My favorite rendition or version, but still worth listening to, Waltz of the Flowers by electronic musician Mike Muniak. This is from 2005. And again, you know, there's a lot you can do to this music.
What's interesting to me about this is that you basically get the actual orchestrated, the Tchaikovsky orchestration, which is then layered, right, on top of which is layered this kind of electronic mix.
Right. I mean, he's definitely keeping the music intact, and even the tempo is a very danceable tempo.
Definitely.
You might argue that Tchaikovsky's version in Fantasia, not so danceable. Not so danceable. I mean, and certainly not with the choreography that we do, right? There's some tempos that are unbelievably slow compared to what we do, and vice versa, quite fast. So it is a testament to how durable this stuff is.
Let me just read a couple of comments. Email from Jen. We took our son when he was 3 to see the Nutcracker. Someone gave us free tickets, so we planned to leave after the first act as we didn't think he could sit still that long. Needless to say, he begged to stay and finish the story. Everyone should see it live at least once in their lives. Now he's 17. We still enjoy the Battle of the Nutcrackers on TV. Good memories. And, I mean, it's interesting what a child can sit through when they're really engaged.
Absolutely. I've heard many stories like that where parents were worried and skeptical and the kids sat there rapt. Right. You know, kids make noise. So do adults. It's really okay, right? It's if they're, as long as they're enjoying it,
right,
it's all good.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful column that Miss Manners, Judith Martin, as Miss Manners wrote about taking your kids to the Nutcracker and how it can be this kind of extraordinary learning experience for them because they make the point that you put on nice clothes and you go and as she said, you know, if more than a few children who've gone to see it have ended up in ballet school, which is sort of the ultimate, you know, character shaping experience. So she's a great fan of the Nutcracker and the ability it has to teach children something. That's well put. Yeah.
To civilize us.
Well, we bring in many, many school groups to our dress rehearsal, and it's very clear to those of us who are performing that for some of them, this is probably their only time, but probably the only time of year that they are asked to sort of behave and appreciate in a particular way. And just that in and of itself is very powerful, I find.
Well, we're talking about the Nutcracker, frankly talking about the music of the Nutcracker, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I want to play another piece of music, and this is one of your favorite part, David.
The Dance of the Reed Pipes or the Miltons.
Yeah. The Dance of the Miltons, and this is band leader Xavier Cugat's 1958 rendition. Let's give it a listen. Xavier Cugat's 1958 rendition of Dance of the Merlitons. And why do you like that so much, David?
Well, why I like that piece is not necessarily what I what we just heard. What I love about the Tchaikovsky is this kind of oddly breathy quality and all the stirring that goes on in the flute parts. But here I love that he's a Latin band leader. He's given it a kind of Latin flavor. It still preserves the piece, but it has a whole new take on it.
Yeah, it's very respectful, and yet it reminds me of Begin. You know?
Yeah.
Right. And why not? Let me read an email from Cletus. It says, I owe so much to the Nutcracker. Like your guest, David Fox, I came to it late in my 30s. And though a rock dancer's mother and colleague of mine at Holy Family College, I landed the plum part of Drosselmeyer in an off Broad Street production at the Klein Jewish Y in Northeast Philadelphia. I loved it because I learned, among other things, how to lift a dancer, how to juggle, how to do much more magic for the children. And in so doing, felt like a child myself. In my mind, it is simply a phenomenal show. I look forward to taking it in every year. I mean, Terrific memory.
Yeah, terrific memory for so many families and so many different memories. I mean, my family, too, has been very much touched by this. I have a child who's now 13, and she started seeing the Nutcracker when she was baby in my father's arms in the wings, and now she's dancing in the Nutcracker.
Oh, she is? Yeah. In this production?
No, we live in Boston.
Right.
So she dances up there.
She's dancing up there. Yeah. But Drosselmeyer, we haven't talked about him very much.
Drosselmeyer is a perfect example of one of these great character roles for a essentially retired dancer. It still has a lot of movement in it, but it's more of a kind of character acting role. And for a number of years, I know at City Ballet, Bart Cook, who was one of the prominent male dancers in the company, kind of owned the role of Drosselmeyer. It's more recently been done by Robert LaFosse, who, interestingly, they each have a somewhat, I've seen both of them do it, and they have a different take on it. Bart Cook is a little more sinister. Robert LaFosse is kind of foppish. They sort of, within the boundaries of the ballet, can invent it and play with it, even within the Balanchine rather tightly established choreography.
Why do you think that this the Nutcracker has become the kind of soundtrack for Christmas in America? I mean, I know it's performed and enjoyed in other parts of the world, but it seems like America has really embraced this.
It's very excerptable, right? You can just pull out little bits here and there, and everybody right away has heard it, recognizes it, knows where it comes from. And, you know, Swan Lake has a great tune. It has a lot of great tunes, but Swan Lake is to be experienced more in a large arc. And this is just so easy to slice it up and dice it up, and it retains its authenticity.
What do you think, David?
I think it's also a piece that is specifically about Christmas. And I think, you know, it evokes a certain kind of European idea of Christmas, which I think is very much part of our culture. Has been certainly I grew up with this. I, you know, family. My mother was a German born. She was the first generation to move to the United States, and I think, but I think the romantic European Christmas traditions are very much with us in our ornaments, our style, and very strongly part of Nutcracker.
Right. And nostalgic.
And nostalgic.
And nostalgic.
Indeed.
And one more thing I would say is that it's Christmas music without having any words. It's not sung. It's not Christmas carols. And it's a great alternative.
Well, this has been so much fun. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Merry Christmas. And thanks for joining us talking about the Nutcracker. Beatrice Jonah Afrin, music director, conductor of the Pennsylvania Ballet. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Talking about it. Have fun conducting until
Thank
the
you.
Rest of
I
the
will.
Year. The Pennsylvania Ballet performing George Balanchine's The Nutcracker at the Academy of Music through December 31st with the Philadelphia Boys Choir. David Fox, as always, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and English. We want to close things out with Bounce of the Sugar Plum Fairy by John Kirby and his orchestra from 1941.